Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, David McBride for the appellee, and I rise to introduce to the court Mr. Avi Josephson from the firm of Bernstein, Litowitz, Berger, and Grossman in New York. And he's been admitted pro hoc for purposes of this argument. He'll make the argument for the appellees.
Welcome to the court.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Neil Levitsky from the law firm of Fox Rothschild. We represent the appellant, Nico Willert. It's my pleasure to introduce to the court Don Chase from the law firm of Morrison Cohen in New York. Mr. Chase has previously been admitted pro hoc vice by this court, and he will be making oral argument this morning.
Welcome to the court.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
There's really no dispute here about the significant damages that the Stonington Fund suffered in connection with the transactions at issue here. And that loss certainly is tragic, but what we're facing on this appeal is my client, Nico Willert, who is now has a $750 million judgment hanging over his head. And it's based on a default. And there are a number of critical issues that we believe are raised for this court, some of first impression. But before I get to those issues, and there's about five of them, Nico Willert, I think that it's important to understand what his position with the company was. He did not control LNH. There's no allegation of that. He's not alleged to be a shareholder. There's not even alleged to be that he profited in any way from this transaction or stood to profit in any way from the transaction. This is not an instance that we've all heard about over the past years, like Enron and WorldCom and all the scandals that arose, where you have individuals like Nico Willert taking away tons of cash out of the company. This Nico Willert is not alleged to have taken a dime out of this company.
It's about whether the vice chancellor abused his discretion in denying a motion to lift the default judgment?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Why are we talking about the merits?
I wanted to, in terms of the framework of who Nico Willert is, I just wanted to raise that in advance so the court understands.
We're not a jury. We're focused on the legal argument that's central to whether or not the vice chancellor abused his discretion.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'll address that immediately. The first issue that we raise, and I think it's important with the framework that each side has presented in terms of this appeal is different. What we say is that even before you can enter a default judgment, the plaintiff has to show that the defendant, Nico Willert, was properly served, that the complaint properly pled a cause of action against him, and that there was no other reason why the default judgment should not have been granted. The first point I want to raise is the service part of it. As we've pointed out in our briefs, we do not believe that service complies with the Hague Convention. Now, the Chancery Court did not decide that issue below. They effectively assumed that service was an improper, but they said that Nico Willert waived his right to raise the defective service of process because he did not timely appear. We believe that that is incorrect as a matter of law for a number of reasons. First of all, Article 15 of the Hague Convention itself
decided service at least as to Lernout, right?
Yeah, but I'm just dealing with Nico Willert.
Were they in similar positions or not?
In terms of service?
Right.
Well, service for each of them is individual, but the court did not decide that service was proper on Nico Willert. What it held in its opinion was that any objection to defective service was effectively waived by him not timely appearing.
Well, I'm looking at page 9 of the opinion, dated July 8, 2003. For the two reasons addressed above, Lernout was properly served under the Delaware long-arm statute and the convention. And then it went on to say there's a third reason. And that was the waiver. But there was a holding, at least as to what was proper service under the convention, as to another
Well, I know there's an express holding that, in a footnote, that the reason why it was rejecting, at least as to Willard, and I don't have it right in front of me, was because it was not timely raised. But irrespective of that, let me just point out, first of all, as to that reason, that would be improper under both Article 15 of the Hague, which says that you can't find a default judgment if services is not in accordance with the Hague.
Now, you're basically, we would effectively be overruling all of the lower court decisions on what is proper service under the Hague Convention, with the exception of King. Is that right?
As far as I know, Your Honor, there are only three decisions on this point in Delaware. We have the King case, which held that it was not proper service to serve by mail. We have the Quinn case, which in dictum suggested that it would be proper, but said it was a close call and specifically said that this is dictum and it's not deciding that issue. It held on a different basis under the motorist statute that service on the Secretary of State was sufficient and therefore it didn't have to address the issue ultimately. And then you have the Wright case, which held contrary to the King case. So really what you have is a conflict below. You don't have a lot of case law in Delaware on the point.
But more important, the matter is everyone's following Quinn or Wright, not King, as far as you know. Is that the practice?
I don't know what the practice is otherwise in Delaware. All I know is from the reported decisions, Your Honor. But what I will say is we're dealing with an international treaty. An international treaty is not simply a matter of Delaware law. It's the same treaty that applies throughout the United States. And quite frankly, there are numerous courts that have held that service by mail is improper. And there are, but there are a split of opinion, and it hasn't gone to the U.S. Supreme Court yet. Maybe it will, but right now, there's a whole string of courts on both sides, and I wouldn't say that any side holds the upper hand on that issue.
Is it accurate that Belgium has not objected to service by mail?
Is it accurate that Belgium has not objected? I don't think there's a specific objection noted, but if they construe the Hague Convention the way a lot of U.S. courts have construed the Hague Convention, then there would be no need to object. The point to object would be if there were something, some controversy.
I'm looking at the same page in footnote 14. The court is also persuaded by the fact that objection to any article is permitted in certain states found it necessary to object to service of mail. Belgium did not object to service by mail, as did other signatories.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, can you cite me the page in the record?
Your opening brief.
I'm sorry.
This is the July 8th, 2003 opinion, page 9.
Okay, and...
And I'm looking at footnote 14. Do you dispute what's in that footnote?
I'm not disputing what's in that footnote per se, Your Honor, that Belgium did not object to service by mail. What I am saying is there would be no reason for Belgium to object to service by mail if they construed the provision of the Hague Convention in accordance with how numerous courts in the U.S. have similarly construed it. When you look at, and you know, what it really comes down to is a very elementary principle of statutory construction. The only provision that's relied upon to support service by mail is Article 10A. And Article 10A uses the term send judicial documents, not serve. Every other provision in that in the convention, including the ones immediately after and immediately before, use the term serve and talk about service. So a lot of courts have looked at that under traditional notions of statutory construction and said, when you use the term, when they used a different term, unless you're going to say that that it was a Scrivener's error, that it had to mean something different, and they found that it meant other documents after service can be done by mail. Indeed.
Well, there was service here on the Secretary of State, right?
There was service on the Secretary of State, I believe. I think that there's a note in the docket to that effect. There wasn't an affidavit of service submitted, as far as I could see, to that effect. But irrespective of that, Your Honor, here in all the articles, there's a whole procedure set up for service of process. And what the courts who have found that mailing is not proper have said is that why would you go through all these processes and in the convention only to say that you could just serve by mail? Who would follow any of these conventions if all you had to do was serve by mail? And that's the reason why we think that it's very clear from a reading of pure statutory reading of the Hague Convention that service by mail is not proper. And we think that the long line of cases that we have cited on that point support that.
So the Quinn case is wrong.
Absolutely. Well, the Quinn case only talked about it. And the Quinn case is very interesting because the Quinn case noted that it was extremely difficult issue and said that it was tentatively is the word they used, tentatively leaning on that side of the coin. But they went through a thorough analysis with all the court cases and all the rationales, and they made it very clear that it was just dictum. I think the case that you would be referring to that we would be overruling essentially is the Wright case that followed it. But I think the Quinn makes the arguments on both sides. Apart from, you know, assuming that apart from the mail issue in terms of the Hague, we've also raised the translation issue. Willard was served only with an English document. The languages of Belgium are French and Flemish. As we pointed out in our moving papers, under Belgian law, all legal process documents have to be served in one of the official languages of Belgium. And that was not done here. And under the Hague Article 5, that also would have been improper. So, and that hasn't been really addressed by the defendant here. So we believe, in sum, that service was improper.
Does the record reflect whether your client speaks English?
The record does not reflect whether my client speaks English, but I would add to that, the question isn't whether he speaks English. If you're a foreigner, when you're dealing with legal documents, even if you have any kind of a facility with English, I speak French, but I wouldn't want French legal documents coming to me and having to deal with them. There's specialized language, there's specialized implications, so whether you can converse to some extent in English doesn't mean that you should be served process and legal documents with all sorts of legal effect in anything other than a language that you feel foremost comfortable with, French or Flemish in Belgium.
And is that because the International Convention says so, or is that?
Yeah, I'm referring to art. I'm sorry.
Or is because there's some other legal principle? Because it strikes me that if you subject yourself to the possibility of the legal service of process in a particular jurisdiction, it seems logical you would expect to be served in the language of that jurisdiction.
I understand Your Honor's logic there, but the point is that when you're for in terms of the Hague Convention itself, there's some elementary protections that are afforded foreign nationals.
Okay, so you're relying entirely on the applicability of the Hague Convention.
Yes. Okay. And I think the Hague Convention, there's no question that the Hague Convention applies to service of process in this case, because you're serving process abroad and it automatically applies, and it's a treaty, applies to all the states across the U.S. uniformly.
I think, unfortunately, we understand supremacy and preemption better than we need to.
Okay. That is an issue of first impression for this court.
Wright expressly held that papers served on the French defendants did not have to be in French. Is that right? Or not? Is there a lower court ruling in Delaware on this language issue?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I'm not aware of that. But, you know, each foreign country would be different. The point is whether a foreign country, the central authority, whether they would require that it be translated or not. Some countries may not require that. But the fact is we submitted, and it was not controverted by defendant, we submitted a document which showed that under Belgian law, the legal documents have to be translated into either French or Flemish.
And Article 5 specifically requires that?
There
be service in documents in the local language?
Yes, I believe so. Article 5 says that the document is to be served on the first paragraph above. The central authority may require the document to be written in or translated into the official language or one of the official languages of the state addressed. And here, as we've submitted, Belgian law required that it be translated into French or Flemish. But moving on, Your Honor, the second part of the reason why we don't think a default judgment should...
But that assumes, your argument assumes, does it not, that Secretary State's service, the service on the Secretary of State doesn't matter, that anything that goes to Belgium must be in the local language.
I don't think that there's been any argument made here that service of the on the Secretary of State alone would obviate the requirement in terms of service on the on Defendant Willard in accordance with the Hague. I'm not aware of any argument that was made to that effect. Your Honor, in the second critical aspect of this is that we don't believe that the complaint in this action, the well-pleaded allegations of the complaint in this action, set forth a claim against Nico Willard. And toward this end, you know, obviously if any reading of that complaint points out the difficulties of setting forth a claim against Nico Willard. He is mentioned individually, I think, in one paragraph early on as to what his position is in the company. And other than that, the only allegations now attributed to him are references to LNH executives, and there is no single representation or statement attributed to him. One statement says LNH representatives painted a rosy picture, whatever that means. Clearly, all the executives didn't use the word rosy picture, but there's nothing identified as to Nico Willard as to what he specifically said to the plaintiffs, whether he even attended a meeting with them, whether he took any action or even had knowledge of the alleged fraud. And I want to point that out, which is critical. Looking at the complaint itself concedes that the fraud emanated from Korea and Singapore in Asia and the Asian fraud. They haven't done anything in the complaint to try to tie Nico Willard to those foreign subsidiaries or how he knew or would have known. Nothing in the complaint about that. What we say is that under any reading of this complaint, if any fair reading of this complaint, there is no cause of action set forth against Nico Willard. There is no way for him to know specifically what it is being alleged that he individually did. What you have is a lot of allegations about LNH, the company did this and the company did that, but in essence, the claim against Nico Willard is that he was an officer of this company and therefore he's responsible for fraud. And we cited to a long line of cases where that's just not proper under pleading. You can't simply say somebody's an executive of a company and therefore they're guilty of fraud.
Did you want to save your last 2.5 minutes?
Is this...
The yellow light means you're into your rebuttal.
Okay, so I want to reserve the last 2.5 minutes.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, and Avi Josephson on behalf of the appellees. I'd like to, before I address the points that were raised, just reiterate that we got to this case because not just of a simple default, a technical default by a couple of days, by a year-long absence in this court by the defendant after he appeared in other actions related to this case, after other defendants in similar positions appeared in this case. This goes to the issue of excusable neglect. In order to vacate the default, to set aside the default, it's not sufficient to simply question the sufficiency of the complaint. He must also address excusable neglect. There's no question that Justice Jacobs, sitting in Chancery Court, found that there is absolutely no excuse for the egregious neglect, the failure to appear in this case. And that's the context in which this case arises, that after promptly filing an action upon the revelation of a massive fraud of the company, which they had simply recently done a $500 million transaction, the appellees promptly filed the case only to find it sitting for a year, waiting for the defendants to appear here while they appeared elsewhere and defended other actions and allowed the available insurance, for example, to be depleted in the course of defending those actions.
Before you get into the rest of your argument, I have a factual issue to straighten out in my own mind. There was one individual defendant who appeared, wasn't there? And wasn't the claim against him dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor. Gaston Bastiens did appear in this court. He timely appeared. The case against him was ultimately dismissed in this court. It was actually refiled. We filed a new case against him together with other cases that were proceeding in Boston, simply because at that point we had Stonington plaintiffs had filed actions initially in Delaware. They were transferred to Boston against other parties involved in the case, not parties who would be subject to these same rescission claims and rescissory damage claims. And once it was clear that this action was not going to merely proceed and Bastiens had appeared here, he was dismissed here. He was named again in a suit that was consolidated with the pending actions in the federal court in Boston, and he answered the complaint in those actions.
Well, what was the basis for the dismissal here?
It was a voluntary dismissal by the plaintiffs. At that point, it was simply, I think, a litigation decision to not proceed in two different fora. We initially thought that all litigation would be in Delaware, whether in the Chancery Court or in federal court. And once the claims asserted initially in the District of Delaware were transferred by their defendants to the District of Massachusetts, and it was clear that the claims against the three defaulting defendants were not going to proceed, at least immediately, into litigation, the decision was made simply for efficiency purposes to proceed with Mr. Bastiens in the same forum as the other defendants. So the claims were voluntarily dismissed. They were refiled in the District of Massachusetts.
You're saying the same complaint as was lodged in this jurisdiction was filed in Boston?
No, Your Honor, it was not the identical complaint. At that point, there had been additional discovery obtained and the complaint was supplemented. It was not the identical complaint. It arose out of the same facts.
Right. What I'm concerned about is the possibility that the complaint in this action was defective, failed to state a claim, that the one appearing defendant came in and said, you know, you don't have a claim stated here, I'm moving to dismiss, that, as you say, as a tactical matter, you decide, well, we'll switch you over to the other litigation in Massachusetts, because that way we're left with, the good news, bad news kind of situation of we now have nobody appearing in Delaware, correct?
Correct.
And we can proceed to get a default judgment because there's nobody who's going to challenge the sufficiency of the complaint, whereas if Bastion stays here, it may turn out that we don't have an adequately stated claim. So can you help me with that concern?
Yes, Your Honor. It's always been our position that this complaint, while not the most artfully drafted, we concede, is sustainable. It does state a claim against all four of the individuals named in the complaint, and that it could have been sustained had it ever been fully briefed and resolved. And the decision to dismiss Mr. Bastiens and to pursue claims against him in Boston was made simply for the efficiency of not proceeding with similar claims in two different courts. And once the decision was made to dismiss the case here and refile it, given the additional discovery that had been obtained, there was simply no reason not to proceed with a more substantive complaint. It frankly drew from the allegations that were filed against some of the other parties that appeared.
Well, did that additional discovery give you any information about Mr. Willard's involvement?
In the course of discovery in the past several years, we've certainly obtained additional information about Mr. Willard's involvement. That being said, it's still our position that the allegations that were alleged against him initially and the complaint that is operative before the court does state a claim against him and against Mr. Learnout, Mr. Houseby, and that complaint, if visited under Rule 12, would be sustained.
Well, okay. I'm trying to read between the lines here. In terms of the additional discovery against Mr. Willard, does that provide more evidence or some evidence in support of your claim of his knowledge or not?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, it does, Your Honor. If there's no question, if forced to amend at this point, if we were remanded and asked to amend, we could frankly write a book about Mr. Willard's involvement in the fraud based on the additional discovery that's been obtained since this complaint was filed 7 years ago.
Thank you.
With regard to the issue of a service of process that was addressed, a few points I'd like to address. One is that regarding whether or not service was effected properly, the Quinn case and the Wright case are directly on point for two reasons. One is that before even reaching the issue of whether or not service can be effected under Article 10A of the Hague Convention by simply mailing a document, the court can conclude without reaching that conclusion and without touching upon an issue of first impression that simply because we were proceeding under the long-arm statute, as were the plaintiffs in Quinn and in Wright, that by serving upon the Secretary of State, we were allowed under Article 10A to send the notice of that service, send a copy of the complaint and the summons to the defendant in Belgium, and there's no question, and I don't believe that the appellant contends, that Article 10A of the Hague prevents you from sending a copy, a notice of service upon the Secretary of State
does
to a defendant.
Does it have to be in the local language?
It does not, Your Honor. The provision of the Hague that appellant cites to, Article 5, addresses translation when a process is being served under Article 5. Article 5 addresses service through a central authority established by the Hague participants. And when service is made under Article 5 through a central authority, that is, the document is tendered to the central authority and they serve it, the central authority may request, it's not required to request, it's not required translation, but the central authority may request for service under Article 5 translation. We did not proceed to the service under Article 5. We didn't go through the central authority. We served under Article 10. There is no provision, no similar provision for translation with regard to service under Article 10.
Do they make that request in the individual case or through some broader statement?
Your Honor, I frankly don't know the answer because we didn't proceed under Article 5 with regard to these defendants. I don't know whether it's a matter of course. Belgium simply states that is, there's an established practice through the central authority in Belgium that you must translate.
Well, your colleague suggested to us that it wasn't a matter of practice, it was a matter of Belgian law, well, that the documents, if served on one of their citizens, had to be translated into or originate in the either Flemish or French.
There were two references that the appellant made. One was to service under Article 5. The other was a reference to just Belgian law requiring translation into specific languages. It's our position that we weren't proceeding under Belgian law. We were proceeding under Delaware law with claims here, and that to the extent we're under the Hague Convention, if we weren't going under Article 5, there is no requirement for translation. I don't know what the other requirements of Belgian law are to service. We certainly weren't attempting to comply with Belgian
law. It sounds to me like I'm going to have to learn more about the Hague Convention than I ever imagined, but I took the argument to be that each signatory to the Hague Convention could, under their own individual state's law, opt for translation into the designated local language, and that it wasn't based on what a central authority under the convention said. Each state could opt in or opt out of that requirement. Is that incorrect?
I believe that's incorrect. I believe there's guidance on that, partially in the Wright decision, which does address the question of translation and found that in a completely similar situation, a service with a claim under the long-arm statute in the U.S. and Delaware, proceeding under Article 10A, translation was not required. There's not an extensive decision in the Wright case, but the Wright case cites to one decision for that principle. It's a case in Pennsylvania, which specifically delineates between service under Article 5 of the Hague through a central authority where translation may be required, and translation in Article 10A, where there's absolutely no requirement or even provision for request for translation under Article 10A. That's the Sandoval case. It's cited in Wright, where Wright says a translation is not required.
At the risk of confusing everyone, even beyond my confusion, turn back to the first issue of pleading with particularity because it's a fraud complaint. In your answer to Justice Berger's question about what you have now learned as a result of discovery that would allow you to amend the complaint, in addressing whether or not a default judgment is proper or a decision not to lift a default judgment is proper, at what point do we examine the complaint to determine whether it has been pled sufficiently consistent with our pleading with particularity rule for allegations of fraud? The complaint as it stood when it was served, or the complaint as discovery has added facts to assist you in redrafting it if you were to amend it?
In arguing that the complaint is sufficient for entry of a default judgment, we're not basing that upon the fact that we could amend it with additional facts learned. The complaint.
You're saying, contrary to what your colleague said, the complaint that was filed and was served is sufficiently pleaded with particularity to sustain a fraud claim against Mr. Willard.
Yes, Your Honor. Can
you explain why? Because it strikes me there would have to be some amplification of the facts as your colleague explained them to us.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The key issues in this complaint that have been challenged are, as you said, whether it alleges fraud with particularity. The issues really there are, did Mr. Willard, is he alleged to have made a false statement, and he's alleged to have acted with knowledge. With regard to the false statements, the appellant repeatedly points to the allegation of a rosy picture. It's true the complaint alleges that rosy picture was painted. The complaint also goes through in extreme detail, along with extensive quotation and citation, the representations and warranties contained in the merger agreements. Those were specific representations. They are quoted in the complaint. And the representations are that Learnout and Housby's financial statements filed with the SEC were true, they were reliable, they were prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, and they comply with the requirements of the federal securities laws. It actually cites specifically the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. That is specifically alleged in the complaint, and the section of the merger agreements is quoted from explicitly incorporates, by reference, those SEC filings.
And Willard signed the merger agreement?
He did, Your Honor. The only thing that is not stated in the complaint explicitly is that Willard signed those merger agreements in the context of his position as an officer and director of Learnout and Housby. It's our position, and Justice Jacobs stated this during one of the two hearings below, and it's my understanding it was never contested by Mr. Willard, that because those the merger agreements are cited to and quoted and relied upon extensively, they are incorporated by reference in the complaint. Any argument against this complaint raised under Rule 12 would certainly allow the court to address the documents that are cited therein in their entirety. Frankly, in securities cases, it's not uncommon for the plaintiffs to cite all the damning language that is alleged to be fraudulent from SEC filings, and then for the defendants to say, well, Your Honor, you can look outside the four corners of the complaint. The full SEC filings are incorporated by reference, and there's other language in there which mitigates these claims. So clearly the fact that Willard signed those representations can be considered by the court in looking at the sufficiency of the complaint. Another critical allegation going to knowledge is that Learnout and Housby restated those financial statements, and this is alleged in the complaint, they admitted that the basis for the restatement was that those financial statements contained accounting errors and irregularities. And the complaint alleges that the term accounting errors and irregularities is defined and understood in the accounting literature to mean an intentional misstatement or omission. So the complaint alleges that the SEC filings and financial statements that are warranted to be true and correct in the merger agreements were admitted to be intentionally misstated, to contain intentional misstatements and omissions. And again, because the SEC filings were public documents, these are documents that under a Rule 12 motion, a court could certainly take notice of and consider. And again, while it is not alleged specifically in the complaint, in the course of the Rule 12 motion and looking at the full SEC filings, Mr. Willard also signed those documents, the documents that are alleged to be false and misleading. Those are allegations going directly to questions of scienter, his knowledge, and specifically the falsity of the statements.
I'm missing the connection here. I understand that the financial statements were false and misleading and fraudulent and so forth. And I also understand that Mr. Willard signed a merger agreement and signed perhaps some SEC filings that included these false financial statements. How do we make the connection that he knew that what he was signing was a misrepresentation?
There are two points that go to that, Your Honor. One is that the allegation that the SEC filings he signed were intentionally misstated is, we contend, an allegation that they were intentionally misstated by the individuals who signed them on behalf of the company.
intuitively that doesn't make a connection in my mind. Somebody else puts together the financial statements, not Mr. Willard, right?
In this case, we don't know what his role was in compiling the financial statements, but assuming that others participated in preparing them, yes, that's true.
So just by the fact that he signs them, we should assume that he knew that they were false?
I think it's fair when considering the sufficiency of the complaint under Rule 12 and the allegation that they are intentionally misstated and he's the one who, by signing them, is making that statement on behalf of the company. It's certainly a fair inference to draw in favor of the plaintiffs in interpreting the complaint under Rule 12 that they are intentionally misstated by the officer or director making the statement. If that's not sufficient, there are also allegations in the complaint that the defendants, these defendants, intentionally misled Stonington. And this gets into one of the issues where we can concede that the complaint is not artfully drafted. This is the use of the term LNH executives. There are two allegations that LNH executives intentionally and deliberately misled Stonington and concealed information from the plaintiffs. The only question then is whether the term LNH executives as used in this complaint, which specifically names only four senior executives of Learnout and Houseby who were involved in the merger, who signed the merger documents, who signed the SEC filings, whether the term LNH executives refers to Mr. Willard in the context of this complaint. And we contend that it does, that examining this complaint in context under Rule 12, looking at the totality of the complaint and the documents incorporated by reference, the complaint would not be dismissed under Rule 12 simply because the term LNH executives is not defined, when here there are only four LNH executives, Mr. Willard is one of them, and he signed the only document alleged to be false in the case, the merger agreements and the SEC filings. And there are two allegations in the complaint that those LNH executives deliberately and intentionally misled Stonington in the course of inducing them to enter into the merger. Now, the only question there is whether LNH executives refers to Mr. Willerton's co-defendants named in this case, and we contend that in the context of this complaint, which names only four executives, there's no one else to whom it can refer. I'm happy to address other questions if there are any on the sufficiency of the complaint. A couple other points. One with regard to translation, the question was asked whether the record establishes whether Mr. Willard actually speaks English. I would note that the affidavit he submitted does not address the language he speaks, but on the record below at hearing, I believe that his counsel stated that he does have a working knowledge of English. Again, I'm not sure entirely the relevance of the determination because we still contend there's no requirement for translation. But if there's some issue going to whether neglect was excusable because he didn't understand the document, that certainly hasn't been established. And if anything, there's an indication that he has a working knowledge of English and may have understood the document, if that's what one of the issues translation goes to.
And what's the basis for determining without a hearing that LNH stock was essentially worthless in order to compute the damages?
In connection in support of the motion for an award of damages, Stonington submitted an affidavit, and in connection with that affidavit submitted documentary evidence, including what are uncontested documents from public sources identifying the price of LNH stock. And those were submitted, again, as exhibits to an affidavit. We represented those were true and correct copies of publicly available sources regarding stock information. In response, Mr. Willard submitted no evidence, no affidavit contesting any of the facts that we submitted in support of our motion or contesting any of the facts contained in those exhibits. And the Chancery Court, operating under Rule 55, has discretion to take whatever evidence it deems necessary in order to fix the damages.
So he had the full opportunity to produce a counter affidavit and did not do so.
Yes, Your Honor. He submitted a brief in opposition to the plaintiff's briefs. He submitted no evidence with that brief. He provided in that brief several arguments that he might raise at some point. Several of those could have been supported by public information regarding stock price information, regarding opinions from experts regarding the value of stock in certain situations. And nothing was submitted, no request for an extension to respond to the motion for default that, as far as I know, was requested for the purposes of obtaining a different additional public information or expert opinion to respond to the information that plaintiffs submitted in support of their motion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I realize I only have 2 minutes here and a number of points to cover, but one issue that I want to raise off the bat is the suggestion was made that if there is not excusable neglect, that there's not an opportunity to challenge the sufficiency of the complaint. I just want to point out, first of all, that the sufficiency of the complaint in terms of a default judgment can be raised for the first time on appeal. And I've cited cases to this, but it's Nishimatsu 515 F. 2nd 1200, 1206 Fifth Circuit, TWA 449 F. 2nd 51, 57 to 58 Second Circuit. It's very clear that separate and apart from the excusable neglect issue, that if you do not have, and this is on all the authorities, a sufficiently pled complaint in compliance with Rule 12 and 9B, that you are not entitled to a default judgment. The only thing a default judgment does is admit the well-pleaded allegations of the complaint, period.
Well, that included, according to your opponent, the intentional misstatement of the financials.
Your Honor, but beyond that, that's what we argue in terms of this complaint is either it's conclusory, in which case conclusory allegations don't admit anything, or it's not detailed enough. The point here with respect to Nico Willard, yes, they allege that this amorphous group of LNH executives deliberately misled them, but they didn't specify what it is that Willard knew or when or how he deliberately misrepresented, what his individual statement was. I think if you read this complaint, you will have extreme difficulty ascertaining what exactly it is that they allege Nico Willard did. Yes, there's a blanket statement he intentionally misled them. How? What? What did he say?
That was just answered, the warranties in the merger agreement.
If we talk about the merger agreement, let's start with the fact that the merger agreement is an agreement between LNH and Dictaphone Corporation. Plaintiffs in this action are not a party to the merger agreement. Nico Willard is not individually a party to the merger agreement. There's provisions in the merger agreement that it does not confer any benefits to somebody who is not a party to the merger agreement. The point here is that those if I'm an executive of Microsoft and I sign an agreement for Microsoft, I certainly don't expect to incur individual liability for warranties and representations in that agreement, especially $500 million, $750 million worth of liability.
They're false?
If you know they're false, here's the point. As a director, yes, you can be responsible if you actively participated in the fraud. If I'm simply an executive and the only reason why you're saying I am liable is because I signed a document, that's not enough. But if you actively participated in the fraud and you've put forth facts in that complaint to show the active participation in the complaint, in the fraud, then you could assert a claim against it. I submit to you that if you look at this complaint, you will not find any allegations that show any active participation that can be inferred by Nico Willard, other than the fact that he has a position at the company.
Well, your time has expired, but let me assure you, to the extent which your demeanor is expressing exasperation because you're out of time and there are other things you'd like to cover, I assure you that we will look at all five of the points that you've raised that are raised in the brief, and we'll consider the oral argument and think what you might have argued had you had more time. I assure you of that.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
With that in mind, we'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.